It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
And that is the wail of a common loon, a long-range contact call between mates. That call is from the Loon Preservation Committee, which describes these agile divers as a symbol of wilderness in early summer.
Now, a new report from the Loon Project finds that murky water in northern Wisconsin lakes and climate change are contributing to declines in our state's loon population.
Walter Piper is a biology professor at Chapman University and leads the project. Walter, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
So your report in the Journal of Ecology on loons is trying to determine what is contributing to this decline. What are you finding in northern Wisconsin?
Well, just to explain the decline very quickly, there's been decline over the last quarter century since the time we've been doing our work in the masses of chicks, the weights of chicks. And so that's the decline that's been puzzling us, and there's also higher mortality in chicks. And so the question is, what could be causing that? And since they're lower masses, an obvious suspect is food, is that they're not getting enough food. And so we got together with a couple of collaborators at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Max Glines and Kevin Rose, who use satellite data to measure water clarity, and they can go back 40 years in time, and we could pull together their satellite data measuring the water clarity in our lakes together with the chick mass data, the weights of the chicks that we capture when we go out at night. What we found was that there was a very close correlation between the masses of the chicks and the water clarity that the satellite data was showing. So if you had a couple of weeks in July when you had a very turbid water, the water was much less clear than normal. That meant the chicks were going to be much lighter than normal. And if you had a great year for water clarity, a great month, I should say, it's mainly the month of July for water clarity, then the chicks would be fat and sassy. So there was a really strong dependency there.
Oh, so that's interesting. In murky water, those loons have a difficult time diving and seeing their prey. Is that an issue?
That's what we presume. They're visual predators, of course, and they chase their prey, mostly fish, underwater. And so if there's a sudden change in a decrease in the clarity of the water, that seems to make it much more difficult for them to find prey, and the chicks end up suffering. They simply can't find enough food to feed their chicks as much as they would like to. And of course, they have to feed themselves. They have to keep themselves alive. They're long-lived animals, so they have to take an eye to the future and keep themselves alive for 20, sometimes 30 or more years during their entire lives. So
in the summers, too, we also have the difficulties with the algae blooms, the invasives on lakes. Is that an issue for loons?
Well, the second stage of this work, after this initial paper showing that water clarity is a problem, that declining water clarity is a problem for loons finding prey, the second piece of it is to say what might be causing that decline in water clarity. And it could be something as simple as sediment that's washing into the lakes, because we also know that it's linked to rainfall, that higher years of high rainfall reduce water clarity. There's a tight correlation between the amount of rain in July and the clarity of the water in a lake in July. And so it could be sediments that are washing into the lakes. It could be fertilizer, as you suggest with the algal blooms. It could be that nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizers that people are putting out on their lawns, on their lakeside lawns, are washing into lakes, causing a bloom of phytoplankton, which make the water less clear and therefore make the loons struggle to feed their chicks.
We're not sure. You mentioned July. Why is that a sensitive month for the loon population?
Well, because loons, they're sitting on nests now, and the chicks are just about to hatch. And so the chicks typically hatch in June sometime. And so June's an important month, too, but July is the most critical month for most loon pairs because their chicks are rapidly growing from maybe, a week or two of age to 6-7 weeks of age. And therefore, the chicks are very demanding of food and are growing at a rapid rate, providing the parents can provide enough food to allow that to happen. So it's just a critical month for chick growth and survival.
We're talking about environmental risks affecting the common loon population with biologist Walter Piper is here, leads the Wisconsin-based Loon Project. Walter, do you have advice or analysis on how to reverse this trend that you're seeing in the decline of the population?
Well, it's early, so we need to be a little tentative because we're still exploring this pattern. As I mentioned, we're not sure exactly what's causing the decline in water clarity, but there are two factors two ways in which we might be able to affect this pattern, reduce this loss of water clarity. One of them is that it does seem to be rainfall related, and of course, higher rainfall is predicted with climate change. And so if we can continue to try to cope with climate change, reduce fossil fuel burning and so forth, that will help. But that's a giant ocean liner that we're trying to turn around with climate change. And so more directly, if we can figure out exactly what it is that's causing the decline in water clarity, if it, for example, is fertilizers that people are putting on their lawns by the lakeside that are washing into the lakes and causing the decline in clarity, in a way, that's hopeful because that means we can say to people, hey, you know, that those fertilizers that are washing into the lake are hurting the loons. So we kind of hope that it's something like fertilizer that can help us, but we aren't at the stage where we can tell people definitively that is what's causing the problem.
Let's look to a moment to our neighbor, Minnesota. You're replicating this research from the Loon Project in Minnesota. What are you finding compared to your research here in Wisconsin?
Well, Minnesota loons seem to be very similar to Wisconsin loons in all the respects that I've seen. There are slight geographic differences. There are more cattails in the lakes here, for example. So there's slight differences in habitat. But by and large, the Minnesota loons are very similar to Wisconsin loons. In fact, the first wave of data that we have suggests that factors that affect Minnesota loons or affect Wisconsin loons affect Minnesota loons similarly. That is, we also weigh adults, adult males and females, as well as the chicks. And so far, it looks like the average masses of adult males in Wisconsin and Minnesota fluctuate together. So if there's a good year for Wisconsin males, male breeders, that's a good year for Minnesota male breeders. So that's one clear similarity.
How do you weigh them?
We put them in a bag. We put them in a laundry bag, basically a mesh bag, and just hang them from a scale very briefly. It just takes a few seconds, and we take them out immediately and release them in the water. It's not a lengthy process, but it provides such valuable data to us, as we've seen with this water clarity finding that it's really important to get those data.
Well, let's listen to some of their calls. You mentioned May in early June in this nesting period, and this is also the period of hope. Let's listen to a territorial call from a male loon, and this is the yodel. So that is from the Loon Preservation Committee. What does the loon yodel communicate?
It communicates a lot. First of all, it's a voice. It's the male's voice, and it's distinctive. It's unique to that male. And so if you're on a big lake that has several territorial pairs, and we were on one this morning here in Minnesota, you can hear yodels up the lake from other adjacent territories, and you can recognize the voice. You can say, oh, that's the big trout west male yodeling. That's the big trout central male yodeling, and that's the Ox Lake male yodeling from over the highway, and so forth. Huh. So it's unique. It's a voice, just like a human voice is a voice. And it also, of course, it conveys just the occurrence of a yodel conveys territorial aggression and the willingness to behave aggressively if an intruder comes in your territory. And the one final thing that it communicates is that it communicates age. And as a male gets older, its territorial yodel becomes higher pitched. This is a finding from Brian Hooper, who was a postdoc with me a few years ago. So older males have very, very high pitched yodels, and younger males have deep low-pitched yodels. So
you know your research subjects so well. You have such a grounded sense of place. In our just final moments together, what draws you to the loon? What do you love about it?
Well, I do love the calls. And even as a child up in Ontario, we have some cabins on a remote lake. And so I think it's the calls more than anything else that gets called to me.
Aww.
and got me just excited about this species and anxious to, to try to do everything that I can to preserve them. And having worked for 32 years in Wisconsin, I don't want my legacy to be the disappearance of my study animal, because if we can fix that, I'd like to try to help do that.
Walter, thank you for joining us. Walter Piper, biology professor at Chapman University in Orange, California, leads the Loon Project based in northern Wisconsin and author of a new paper in the journal Ecology.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a $3 billion Microsoft project in Wisconsin includes UW-Milwaukee and a plan to help manufacturing companies in the state use artificial intelligence. Meet the head of the university lab at the center of the plan. That's up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For years, Wisconsin has boosted spending for youth mental health services, but families are still struggling to find help for their children. Corrine Hess has the story of what one Fox Valley family has gone through and a content warning. This story contains descriptions of self-harm.
Christine Gerke returned home from parent-teacher conferences last spring and found blood on her bathroom floor. Immediately, Gerke ran to find her daughters. In a bedroom, her 17-year-old was sobbing. Next to her was her 15-year-old. She seemed to be bleeding everywhere.
My oldest daughter had walked into the bedroom at the very moment that the younger daughter had been self-harming. She had probably 100 or more large, long, deep cuts in arms and legs, and we had just found that out.
Gerke and her family would spend months trying to get help for their daughter. They took her to facilities across Wisconsin. They spent hours on the phone with providers and more than 6 months on waiting lists. She said the struggle her family has experienced over the last year illustrates how difficult treating youth mental health can be. Gerke's daughter has been battling eating disorders and bipolar disorder. And Gerke says Wisconsin's system for treating youth mental health is simply over capacity.
There's such a deluge of children, in this very small, limited system.
WPR is not naming Gerke's daughter because she's a minor. In order to avoid identifying her daughter, WPR is also using a name other than the one Gerke is known by. She was one of dozens of parents who shared their experiences through WPR's Wisconsin. According to the State Office of Children's Mental Health, one in four Wisconsin girls has seriously considered suicide. Linda Hall, who heads that office, is blunt about the issues facing teens and their families.
The system is broken, right? If you want to get a mental health appointment, you have to wait 4 to 6 months. Well, kids in crisis, this is not an answer. Sometimes you have to prove that you need mental health treatment. We don't make people do that when they break their arms.
10 years ago, about 15 patients a month went to UW Health's Pediatric Emergency Department for psychiatric care. That number has jumped to 40 visits a month. Governor Tony Evers wanted to increase mental health spending by $500 million last year. About half of that would have expanded mental health services in schools. But most of the money was cut during the legislative budget process. Hall says even without increased state funding, there are some simple steps she hears time and again when speaking with young people.
Kids want to feel heard and they want to feel like they belong.
Looking back, Gerke wishes she would have intervened earlier. She says she wants her story to be a wake-up call for both policymakers and parents. Her daughter stopped leaving her bedroom when she was about 13. She spent too much time on her phone and stopped enjoying the activities she once loved, like reading, kayaking, and bicycling.
All of these thousands of hours that they spend click, click, clicking on their devices, and they don't get outside, they don't breathe fresh air, they don't spend time with friends, they don't spend time with their families.
Gerke asked her daughter what could be done in school to help students struggling with mental health. The girl suggested a half hour of talk therapy, similar to what she has gotten during her inpatient hospital stays. So far, those sessions have been what has helped this young woman the most. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the story is part of an occasional series on youth mental health and Wisconsin's efforts to address it. Read more at WPR.org.
Now, manufacturing in Wisconsin takes a step into artificial intelligence. This month, Microsoft announced that it's investing more than $3 billion in Racine County over the next 2 years.
At the former site of Foxconn, Microsoft plans to build a new data center expected to bring more than 2,000 construction jobs to Wisconsin and an unspecified number of long-term jobs.
The plan includes a partnership with UW-Milwaukee. Microsoft says it will establish a co-innovation lab with the university's Connected Systems Institute.
In an announcement, UW-Milwaukee says the lab will work on artificial intelligence projects with as many as 270 Wisconsin businesses, half of them in manufacturing.
Joe Hammond is the executive director of UW-Milwaukee's Connected Systems Institute. Joe, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Absolutely.
All right, we've got this incoming Microsoft Co-Innovation Lab and UW-Milwaukee, the Connected Systems Institute there, a big part of this. Can you talk about the mission of this cooperative effort?
Sure. So up front, I'll say, you know, big thanks to foundational partners that got us to where we are today. Certainly Microsoft, as well as Rockwell Automation and Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation have been really instrumental in bringing CSI to life, putting us on the map, and have been a key enabler to bringing this new investment from Microsoft to Wisconsin. Part of which will be at Connected Systems Institute at UW-Milwaukee. Microsoft has a series of these AI co-innovation labs across the world. The new co-innovation lab that will live at UW-Milwaukee, Connected Systems Institute, is going to be unique. It'll be the first AI co-innovation lab for Microsoft strictly focused on manufacturing. Also, it's going to be unique in that it'll be the first AI co-innovation lab that is at an institute of higher learning, a university. And so, you know, with this, we'll create a lot of unique opportunities, not only for local, regional, nationwide manufacturers to come and learn and experience, but also a lot of opportunity for faculty and students here at the university to experience hands-on what is AI in manufacturing.
With the work we're going to have here in Wisconsin applied to manufacturing, what kind of AI are we talking about?
There's generative AI applications that can be used to proactively look ahead and help manufacturers forecast changes, help them more intentionally optimize their operation, how they're making the product, how materials flowing through their plant, how their people are actually working in the environment as well. What comes along with that is the necessity for high quality data. And I think that will be, as we're learning from Microsoft, that will be one of the key pieces of education is working with manufacturers to help them understand the need to build that high quality data set so that solutions in their operation will be impactful.
Microsoft estimates that the Co-Innovation Lab is going to work with as many as 270 Wisconsin companies by 2030. Most of those, or at least half of those, manufacturing businesses. Suppose somebody out there is saying, hey, I own or run a manufacturing plant. I'm interested in this stuff. How do they get involved? What can they do to play along with this?
Sure. It's a great question. And honestly, it's an answer that that we are still understanding right now with the Microsoft team. You know, the model that Microsoft uses at their other AI co-innovation labs across the world, it's a sliding scale. It could be anything from a morning or an afternoon consulting session where the manufacturer or the industry company comes in to learn. And it could scale all the way to a 9 to 12 week, very tightly scoped project where Microsoft helps the industry partner build a prototype of a solution that ultimately they can go and deploy in their own operation. So it's there's a lot of different ways to get involved, part of the model that Microsoft follows really is education, right? Is informing and educating the company, in this case the manufacturer, as to where the artificial intelligence tools can make the best impact within their business to drive the right type of improvement.
As you mentioned, this is with an institution of higher learning, UW-Milwaukee. What kind of opportunities are you hoping to see in this new collaboration for students, faculty, and staff at UW-Milwaukee?
Well, I think first and foremost, the unique opportunity to have a place like this, like the AI Co-Innovation Lab at UWM, it fits nicely with our educational and our research mission. And that's to bring real opportunities to our students, faculty, and staff. You mentioned earlier roughly 270 companies coming through this co-innovation lab by the year 2030. That metric will create a really outstanding volume of hands-on learning opportunities for students and faculty members, for that matter, to get involved with. Talk about a diverse internship. I'm envisioning the future state where we have a team of interns working with us here at Connected Systems Institute. And as part of their internship, they get exposure to 5, 10, 15 unique projects at this AI co-innovation lab over the course of a summer or a semester. So diverse hands-on learning opportunities for students for sure, and for faculty members as well.
We're talking about a new partnership between Microsoft and UW-Milwaukee. Our guest, Joe Hammond, oversees the university's Connected Systems Institute. Joe, what is the timeline you see for when we're going to see Microsoft's part of this up and running and your collaboration with Microsoft rolling, and we'll start to see companies and students participating?
that's a great question. We're working through some of I would say planning logistics right now. We have some space adjacent to our Connected Systems Institute facility that we're going to be refurbishing and building out to really house the Microsoft team of that'll be joining us here at CSI. Timeline for that is still to be determined. We are, I'd say we're optimistically looking anywhere from 4 to 6 months where we have activity starting to be up and running in the lab.
This partnership is new, but the Connected Systems Institute at UW-Milwaukee has been around for a handful of years now. Can you talk about the sort of things you've been doing even before this Microsoft thing came on the radar?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add up front, I'm still very much the new guy here. You know, I've been with Connected Systems Institute now for about 6 months. I came previously from 13 years in industry, locally with a company called Regal Rexnord Corporation, where when I left, I was leading engineering for one of their business segments. You know, the history of Connected Systems Institute, it's been around for about 7 years in concept. Was initially born out of an idea that leadership at UWM and executive leadership at Rockwell Automation had. And really the idea was to build a place with a focus on driving enhancements for manufacturing workforce of the future. And so, you know, along with that, over the past several years, CSI has advanced. Current state, we have and we support educational offerings for the incumbent workforce to prepare them for jobs of the future in manufacturing. And also we've added to that that foundation of education, a consortium of industry partners who are focused on coming together and you know, collectively building a strong network where we can share wins that help everybody learn and grow faster as the pace of technology solutions and manufacturing advances. And what comes along with that are new opportunities for really industry-informed research that will that our faculty members at UWM can focus on to really respond to critical technology needs of manufacturers in industry today.
I want to talk about the future of AI in business. And depending on who I read, Joe, AI is going to radically transform the way we work in the world, or it's all smoke and mirrors and it's a fad and we're not going to hear about it in 5 years. What do you see as the potential for AI in Wisconsin manufacturing in particular?
Many are already using it and they may not even know. I think the productivity gains to be had with, you know, what I would define as, and I'll say this, you know, full disclosure, I'm not the AI expert, right? But many of us are using it for simple productivity gains, you know, email writing, drafting reports, et cetera, that takes time out of our day, that helps us get more work done. Certainly that will have impact in industry manufacturing applications across the state. Beyond that, you know, it's a powerful problem-solving tool that when armed with the right data can be used very effectively to optimize you know, and solve complex problems that could exist in an operation. You know, ultimately that when intentioned the right way will yield a positive impact for that manufacturer's business. And that's really the, you know, one of our big objectives here at CSI is to give manufacturers the tools they need to apply technologies in the right way to give positive impact to their business.
As somebody who works maybe at a factory now might hear all that and say, hey, wait a minute, is this going to be a new form of automation that's ultimately going to put me out of a job? Is this something that could shake up the workforce and allow us to get by with fewer workers and maybe leave more people out of work?
You know, I would argue the opposite. And this is really a core tenet of our work at CSI. And that is we need to give the existing workforce, the current incumbent workforce rather, and the future workforce, we need to train them differently, because the jobs of yesterday, where I may have worked on an assembly line, where I stood for an 8-hour shift and I put two pieces together. Now that job can be automated, true. And now my job is different. Now I need to understand how to program and how to gather data from the robot that's performing that automated assembly. And perhaps I need to learn how to do some advanced automation tasks that I wasn't aware of before automation came into my value stream. So there's when done right, and there are a handful of really good examples to share in the region of companies who have successfully integrated tools like automation, and at the same time given their employees chances to learn and grow, which is really what we're after.
Another concern about data center development in particular, this is from a WPR report. The U.S. Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy said these data centers are basically energy hogs. They consume 10 to 50 times the amount of energy per floor space of a typical office building. Is this a worry, the amount of energy that's going into these data centers that we need to power these very complex AI algorithms?
Oh, it's a good question. And, it points to, I would say it points to a unique opportunity we have, which is different forms of compute technologies that are in really development phase right now that will be more energy efficient, which will allow for more of these advanced AI algorithms, to be running.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Joe Hammond is Executive Director of UW-Milwaukee's Connected Systems Institute. The Institute is partnering with Microsoft to house the nation's first manufacturing-focused AI co-innovation lab.
Coming up, big tree hunting is becoming a competitive hobby around the world.
Out on cliff sides and stuff, there can be very old trees that look gnarly and they've just been there hundreds of years.
We meet two big tree hunters here in Wisconsin. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Only about 1% of Wisconsin's old-growth forests survived the logging frenzy of the 19th and early 20th centuries.
But Wisconsin still contains some majestic trees. Just ask our listeners. Anne from Janesville called in about one of her favorite trees.
In Traxler Park, about a half mile away from me, there is this honking huge cottonwood tree. When you look at it from a distance, it doesn't look very big at all. But when you stand right next to it, it's like, oh my gosh.
And Jeremy from Cato has some favorites.
We have a huge elm tree in our yard. It's one of the only ones in Manitowoc County, and it's just awesome. I love it. But it's not the biggest trees we have. We also have three poplar trees that are just massive. Also pretty cool. We live on an old farm. Thank you.
Anne and Jeremy aren't alone in their love of large trees. Big tree hunting is an international hobby, and it's taken root among tree fans in Wisconsin.
I talked to two Wisconsin big tree hunters to find out what drew them to the hobby and how they search for state champion trees. Fred Hoffman has been hunting for big trees in Wisconsin for about 10 years. Brad Palzik has been hunting for champion trees for about a year now. Brad and Fred, thanks for joining us.
Yep, no problem.
And Brad, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me.
Brad, what first got you into tree hunting?
I think it started during the COVID pandemic there when there was some social distancing. It became, hiking in the woods became a thing I did quite a bit. I'm a surveyor, so I have been outside a lot, during my career. So that started it. I moved out to the village of Pewaukee with my wife, Anna. There's a large white oak tree right across the street from us. And I nominated it to the Wisconsin DNR through their Champion Tree program. And while I was on their site, I decided, you know what, I'm going to try to become a Champion Tree inspector myself. So I applied for that and I got that. So that's kind of how I got into it, through the DNR Champion Tree program.
And Fred, I understand you've been tree hunting for about a decade now. Did you have that tree in your life that started you down that path?
When I was a little kid in my dad's backyard, we had just moved into a house, and he used to cut trees for a living. So he taught me a lot. You know, he'd take me out to the woods, different places, or to different places. He was cutting trees for people. And so I was, you know, ever since a little kid, I was kind of into it. But we moved into this house, and there was a willow tree in the backyard, and it was probably 7 feet in diameter or so. And I remember when I first heard of the Champion Tree program, and I was trying to compare that tree to, you know, different trees on the Champion Tree list. And that's kind of what kicked off. Once I found out about that, I was like, oh, I have a big tree, and just kind of kept going from there, I guess.
And Brad, can you talk a little bit about how the whole championship tree thing works? It's here in Wisconsin. There's also a worldwide community. And the key, as I understand it, is it's by species. So, you know, the willows aren't competing with the redwoods, right?
Correct. Yeah. Each species has its own champion. A lot of states have their programs. Wisconsin did have one. It's been suspended, though. I think it's for, you know, lack of participation, but I think they've had some, I don't know, funding, or, you know, just not enough people to cover the program right now. But yeah, it was going for quite a while there.
Fred, how is a tree measured? What are the different factors that go into the points for a tree?
Well, the first one you're going to look at is it's called the CBH, circumference at breast height, which is normally 4.5 feet above the ground. That's measured in inches. So if you have, say you have a 200-inch circumference tree, that's 200 points. The height of the tree would be measured usually with a, you know, laser rangefinder that does some trigonometry. That's the points would be measured in feet. And then the average crown spread, which is kind of the canopy of the tree, you measure it two ways, get an average, and then you divide that by four, and that you would add those three figures up, and that would give you your total points for a tree.
Brad, you're a surveyor, as you mentioned. So do these kind of measurements come naturally to you?
Well, a lot of times, you know, we're using robots and GPS now. So it's actually kind of going backwards in time, and you're actually measuring with a tape measure.
Right. You're pulling out that high school math, right? Trigonometry.
You know, that's an app you can have on your phone as well. If you want to do it the hard way, you can, but there's apps that do it for you through the trigonometry, and laser rangefinder will also give you a height of a tree.
Fred, how do people go about looking for possible champion trees?
So I'd say a lot of it comes down to luck, just being at the right place. But something that I've begun doing is using Google Maps a lot, actually, and I'll find, you know, different areas of woodland. And there's a site back in the 1930s, the United States actually did an aerial survey with a plane. They did the whole country, and the state of Wisconsin has compiled them, all the photos they took, into an interactive map, so you can actually go back in time. And what I'll do is I'll find to compare the Google Earth photos from today to the photos from the 1930s, and I'll look for trees that were there in the 1930s, and I'll try to go and find those trees to see if they're still around today. And I found quite a few good-sized trees doing it that way.
Can you tell us, Fred, about one of those trees you found with that compare and contrast with the 90-year-old surveys?
Yeah, so out in Kettle Moraine, well, another thing to look for, too, is trees that are out in the open, because then you can really get a, you know, kind of a gauge on how wide the canopy was 90 years ago. And it was off of, kind of by the Kettle Moraine State Forest headquarters, just north of there. I found on the aerial survey a group of probably 15 trees, it looked like, all scattered. And there was a farmhouse in the middle, and you could tell even in the 30s, they were bigger than that farmhouse. So I went out there and pretty much picked out every single one of them still there. And some of those oaks that I saw were 50 to 60 inches in diameter. So pretty good sized trees, not quite champions, but very large trees for the area.
Brad, I understand you've looked at some American elm trees, and a lot of those were wiped out by a blight a little over 100 years ago. What do you think about when you see one of those that made it, that survived that blight?
I think it's pretty amazing to see, you know, trees that have survived through the blight. Supposedly some have a resistance to the EAB. But yeah, I've seen most of the larger elms I've seen are either, I think one I saw, which is the champion in Wisconsin, was in a guy's backyard, kind of an isolated specimen. And quite a few I see out in farm fields that kind of are isolated specimens, but it's to see one, you know, probably how it used to be 50 to 100 years ago, it's pretty cool to see that.
Fred, I always assume if you want to find big trees, you go deep into the forest, but hang on, I was looking at pictures on the DNR website, and some of them are in people's yards. I mean, can you find some of these champion trees in urban areas as well as wildlands?
Yes, there are a good number of trees, actually, that I've seen. You know, the biggest trees that I've seen a lot of times are, like you said, in people's yards or out in the open, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, the growing conditions. You know, it's in your front yard, there's full sunlight, there's not a lot of competition, they usually have decent soils, and the trees in those conditions are going to grow much faster than the trees out in the woods. So there's quite a few. I've seen even street grass trees on the east side of Milwaukee. One of the biggest American elm trees in the entire state is just growing between the sidewalk and the street, right in the middle of the east side.
Brad, I know one challenge is that some big trees might be on private property. How do you approach landowners if you want to examine those trees?
You know, a lot of times what I've found is that if you actually would knock on someone's door and ask them, can I take a look at your tree, they're actually receptive, and they're proud to let you take a look at it. I can't say I've done that a lot, and I don't always recommend that. You don't know who you're going to run into, but there was a large Siberian elm tree. It was enormous. That's not a native tree in Wisconsin, but I did go. It was a farmer, and I saw him out in his yard. I asked him if I could take a look at it. I don't recommend anyone, you know, if you see a huge tree, don't go tromping off into someone's yard and try to take a picture of it. It's not a good idea, but that's how I have done it. Being a part of the Champion Tree Program, it's also possible that I can contact owners, and if it's on private property, remeasure a tree, which actually me and Fred have done that. We measured the largest white oak tree, which is in Stonebank near Oconomowoc. So that was a great opportunity for me and him to see the largest white oak tree in Wisconsin. It's an enormous tree, very impressive tree to see in person.
Fred, how can big tree hunting aid conservation efforts?
I would say, you know, a lot of people, they don't know they're out there, so you can't, you know, conserve something you don't know exists. So I feel like a lot of people, there's like an emotional attachment to these big trees. If you go out and, you know, people don't like when you cut down, you see on the news, oh, they're clearing 200-year-old oak trees to expand a road or something. People don't like to hear that. So I think, you know, making their presence known does help help the conservation effort a bit.
Brad, if somebody's listening and thinking, yeah, this sounds fun, I'd like to do some big tree hunting, how would you recommend they get started?
You know, I think the easiest way to get started is to just look around your neighborhood, find a park. Wisconsin, and, you know, a lot of cities in Wisconsin have tons of parks. Milwaukee County, Waukesha County, you know, most counties have a nice park to start in. And there's a lot of large trees in these parks because they get, you know, they're manicured, they get fertilizer from the grass. That's a good place to start, I think. Wisconsin has a great state natural area collection, almost 700 state natural areas in Wisconsin, which are great places to find old trees. A lot of these are not easy to access, but there are some that are that have paths and are pretty easy to find within, you know, not too far a distance from big cities, Madison and Milwaukee. I would start there. County parks, city parks, state natural areas, and wildlife areas. It depends on how much you want to put into it. If you don't mind prickly ash, mosquitoes, things like that, mud, it's up to you how much you want to put into it, but you can find some big ones out there still.
Fred, do you feel like you're part of a community of big tree hunters?
Yeah, I'd say so. I've actually met some people, including Brad, through just looking for trees, you know, posting pictures online and just talking to different people from all over the country about just big trees, really.
And I want to ask each of you if you have, you know, that holy grail, that big tree, the species you're really hoping to find. Brad, let's start with you.
You know, I'm partial to the oak trees, so I think a bur oak, a huge bur oak, would be something that would be very impressive to find. I found some pretty big ones. That's one of my favorite trees, probably a bur oak.
And Fred, how about you?
I'd probably say the same thing. A bur oak, they're just, you know, slower growing trees. I feel, you know, I've seen many very large cottonwood trees, but they're usually not very old trees. They grow really fast, but you find a very large bur oak and, you know, that tree could have been here hundreds of years. And I think that's probably the most impressive, is finding those slower growing trees, a bur oak being one of them.
That's interesting. When you're standing behind this tree that's been growing slowly for hundreds of years, I don't know, Fred, does it give you some perspective on time, like seeing this thing that's been there a lot longer than we have and that'll be there long after we're gone?
Yeah, I even without, you know, big trees, just old trees in general, because a lot of the old trees, you know, even out on cliff sides and stuff, there can be very old trees that look gnarly and they've just been there hundreds of years. And that's, yeah, probably my favorite thing is just finding those trees and just thinking like how much history they've seen, how long they've been here.
We'll leave it there. Thanks both of you for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Brad Pelzik and Fred Hoffman are big tree hunters here in Wisconsin. They seek out and document big and sometimes unusual trees. They both post their findings on social media. To read about this, see some photos of their favorite findings, go to WPR.org.
And you're listening to Wisconsin Today. And when you're looking for the top news from around the state, check out WPR's podcast called Wisconsin Today Morning News. It's available now, and you can subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org. Now, let's behold this sea change coming to a college sports team near you.
The NCAA and its five largest athletic conferences reached a big agreement allowing athletes to receive pay from the colleges and universities they play for.
Okay, we want to find out about which athletes you think should be compensated, how much should they make, and should women be paid equally to male athletes?
Should they be paid at all? Do you want to see your local Wisconsin campus have paid student athletes? We'd love to get your take on this multi-billion-dollar court settlement. Leave us a voicemail or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Drop us an email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. We hope to share your comments on a future program.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.